Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again. Bracing your bounce. Dunker Nation, let's ride. Nikias, it's been a lot of basketball going on, so it's time to hoop it up.
It is indeed time to hoop it up. Recording on a Thursday, which means we've gotten the opening day slate in. We've gotten the opening Wednesday slate, which had, I think, 37 games on Wednesday night. So we've got to see a little bit of regular season NBA basketball. We'll dig into some of the takeaways, especially since we got some awesome mailbag questions. So thank you to those who have sent those in, not just this week, but throughout the W season and throughout the NBA offseason, throughout preseason play. We appreciate y'all sending those basketball thoughts in. As always, you don't have to have a mailbag prompt. If you're watching something or just thinking about something basketball related and want to get our thoughts, email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. We will get to those questions in the second half of the pod. First, quickly catch up on some news. More movement on the management side on the WNBA front. The Mystics departed with both Eric and Mike Tebow. Eric, the head coach, Mike, the general manager, also former head coach, legendary run with the Washington Mystics. Eric, in particular, most recent head coach of the Mystics, 33-47 across two seasons. Steve, when we have this, I generally start with what were your initial takeaways or how surprised were you? Did the surprise levels alter at all from this one compared to the most recent one that we got?
I don't know. Would probably be my short answer. I mean, I wasn't expecting it. But, you know, if you're winding down a career, and it makes sense for everyone to just kind of part ways at the end of the day. So I kind of get it a little bit. Where were you at?
I wasn't expecting this either. And I think in light of, you know, similar to Dallas, there were a lot of injuries that happened in Washington, but you are now in a situation to where you have your own lottery pick, and we'll get the lottery results, I think, November 17th. You have your own lottery pick. You have another first round pick from the Dream. Like, you feel primed to kind of turn this around pretty quickly, if you would like. So I wasn't expecting a full blown organizational shift. But it does kind of stick with the theme of the W offseason so far, which it appears like there are like three or four coaches or four organizations that are confident with what they have and happy with what they have. And the rest is taking this year heading into this offseason, heading into expansion, heading into new CBA coming up. Hey, let's just press the reset button. Let's make sure we have our things aligned. So I didn't have this one on the bingo card for Washington because of what their particular context is right now.
Well, I mean, if you look at it, one, this is a very hard league to be at the bottom in, to a degree. Mm-hmm. And one thing you just said kind of stood out to me. The feeling that you have what you need going forward may propel you to make a change that maybe you feel like you have to make. Now, I'm not saying that these teams should have made them. That's just a thought bubble in my head. But hey, we're primed for the next step. Let's go ahead and take that first one, rip the Band-Aid off. And now let's get going on the vision. It's kind of wild that just the bottom five, NW just said, we're going to make a change. And I think it speaks to how competitive it is. And I wonder how much the impact of the top has to do with it. Or maybe a sense of there's an opportunity to take another step with what Connecticut has done the last 2 years to a degree, with what Minnesota did this year. Okay, we can make that leap. We can't live with this. Let's try and get a person X to push us in that direction. So I'm not sure, but I think people feel there's an opportunity and they're trying to turn the page.
Well done. But yeah, it's just an interesting time in the W. And we got this most recent news, and like, we're still continuing to hear rumblings of Stephanie Whiten may not be back in Connecticut. I think Annie Constable of Chicago Sun-Times had another piece that listed the Fever, the Sky in particular, as two teams that White could end up coaching if the deal's right, if things break down in Connecticut, et cetera. So like, there may still be more movement. And I'm just kind of, I don't know. It's just surprising to me that all of this movement is happening almost at once. Like, it's just been a super active offseason, and we're pretty early in it. Like, we're recording on a Thursday. The Liberty Championship Parade is literally today.
Yeah.
There you go.
I didn't hear you. What did you say?
The New York Liberty are having their championship parade and celebration today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. But yeah, it's just, we're not far removed. So I guess we're just going to continue to keep eyes on what's happening in the landscape, see who gets hired, et cetera. But it's just an interesting time in the W. All right. Shifting to the NBA side, we did get a lot of extensions. The rookie scale extension deadline passed as we were recording, or before we ended our recording on Monday.
So let's put the hand up real quick. What was it? The Jalen Suggs deal ended approximately 1 minute after we stopped recording, which led Nikias to go into a 15 to 17 minute rant. in which I was like, I gave the disclaimer and he was not pleased, but we have all the extensions, every single one. So take it away.
We sure did. The Houston Rockets getting busy, reaching extensions with both Alperen Şengün and Jalen Green. Alperen Şengün getting a 5-year, $185 million extension. He gets a player option his final year. Jalen Green getting a 3-year, $106 million extension, a player option for the third year. And Jalen, I think naturally Houston wanted to lock both of those players up in some capacity. I thought that you would have at least one of them hitting restricted free agency. Let's preserve our cap space, similar to what the Sixers did with Tyrese Maxey last year. We obviously want you here, but your cap hole is going to be low. Let's see if we can make a splash. The Rockets, before signing these extensions with Şengün and Green, they were projected to have quite a bit of cap space. And depending on how this season was going to go, they would have been one of the more intriguing teams to have a bunch of cap space to throw out. So being able to nail those deals was interesting to me in its own right. Not good or bad, but just interesting. As for the contracts themselves, Jalen Green getting a 2+1, I am still trying to wrap my head around. I think Shams Charania of ESPN reported that this is the first rookie scale extension that we've seen of the 2+1 variety. And Şengün naturally getting a 5-year deal, but it's not his full max. So I guess broadly, Steve, how do you feel about the deals? Would you have made them now versus waiting for restricted free agency?
I don't know if waiting for restricted free agency is the most fun ideal for players these days. And I don't know if it's the, you know, I think if you're a team, you'd rather lock them up when you can. So mm-hmm. I'm glad everyone got the money they were looking for, got deals, got security. I don't think it would have made the biggest difference to me when Houston did it. Probably made it easier to have this done so we can just go out there and play basketball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. I think with Jalen in particular, like this is, it's a big investment, but again, it's not a 5-year investment. So I'm curious to see like what the, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase it. I guess for me, how immediate the payoff is going to be. Because I think the general vibe with Jalen Green throughout his career is that obviously can score. He's growing as a playmaker, not quite there yet. He's growing as a defender, not quite there yet. But we've had like these second half stretches of, holy crap, if this is Jalen Green, this is a star, or at the very least will become a star. We have no doubts about this. And so I just more so want to focus in on like what the level of consistency is going to be for him. Like, what does he reach? Because if he does turn into bona fide star to two, having that third year player option sets him up to get paid quite a bit more than what he's got right now and earlier for Houston. And then in light of the other rookie scale contracts they have on the roster, like that could get a little complicated for Houston in terms of Jalen's up for a new deal or new extension. Plus, well, here's Amen Thompson, et cetera. We got to give him a rookie scale deal. Like the books would just get kind of interesting on that front. That's my only real major thought. Like I do think Jalen has quite a bit of potential. He's a talented player right now. Alperen Şengün, 21-9-5 last year. Obviously, they want to build around him to some capacity. We saw a lot more usage for him offensively. Still waiting to see where he levels at as a defender, but one of the most versatile and talented bigs in the league. So, in a vacuum, if you lock those two dudes up, it's cool. But it's going to be interesting to track over the next couple of years. Keeping with the Jalens, we'll start with Orlando. Jalen Suggs, a 5-year, $150.5 million extension. He also gets a player option in his final year. Jalen Johnson of the Atlanta Hawks getting a 5-year, $150 million extension. And really excited to see what this year is going to look like for him with this new Hawks roster. The Nuggets and Aaron Gordon agreeing to a 4-year, $133 million extension. He also gets a player option in the final year. the Wolves and Rudy Gobert agreeing to a three-year, $110 million extension. He gets a player option in the final year. The Wizards and Corey Kispert agreeing to a four-year, $54 million extension. And the Mavs and Jaden Hardy agreeing to a three-year, $18 million extension. Did any of those names or numbers pop for you?
No, salute.
Okay, there we go.
Shout out to the players. Did any of them pop for you?
Like, very cool for Jaden Hardy to get a level of security. And again, with Dante Exum out, like, I would imagine he's going to get at least an early role off the bench for Dallas. Corey Kispert getting 4 for 54. That feels low in terms of what he brings as a shooter, as a movement shooter, as a closeout attacker. Some passing chops, not going to call him an elite guy, but someone that can keep the ball moving and make some basic reads. But like 4 for 54 feels low for him. I think that more so speaks to how teams or how the Wizards feel about the defense, to where that isn't like 4 for 70 or something like that. But I think there's real upside for him to outperform that contract number. Rudy pointing on the player option and locking in a little bit more long-term security, shaving off some of the tax stuff for Minnesota, felt like good bit of business for both sides. And Rudy's coming off a DPOY year, obviously very important to what they do. It's funny enough, I kind of made the joke about Denver on the last pod and how the general feeling on them just felt a little bit lower, losing KCP, the Aaron Gordon thing not being settled yet. So naturally he just gets the 4 year darn near max extension. So good bit of business there. Aaron Gordon, very obviously important to what Denver does on both ends of the floor, and defended at a near all defense level last year. We talked about that a little bit on the pod. And for the Jalen's, I'm a huge Jalen Johnson fan. And I think clearly they prioritize who he is and what he's going to be in the future. So locking him up, I think that can end up being a bargain if the defense continues to come along, can get some explosive blocks and steals. But again, weak side. Consistency is something that I'm eyeing with him, but as a dude that can get downhill, can initiate, can knock down shots, I think he's a tremendous pick and roll partner for Trae Young in particular. Like, that's a really versatile player, a really fun player in Atlanta. So naturally you lock him up. And with Jalen Suggs, shot 40% from three last year, can attack tilted defenses, can initiate for you. I want to see him continue to grow in that role, but he's one of the best guard defenders in basketball. And I think you can settle, you can lock that in, you do that. He's a huge part of Orlando's defensive infrastructure. So good bit of business, have it for everyone getting their money. That's where I land.
I think, you know, well done. I also would just add, this feels like the era that we're in right now, to where we are going to try and keep our talent, our current core, extend it as long as we can, make sure we have it. And then if we have to pivot, we pivot via trade and see what we can add to what we need. So that's part of why I'm not as surprised with these names getting what they got, because I think they're all part of what these teams are wanting to do going forward. If they hit their ceiling, fantastic. If they don't, they'll have to pivot. But it's a lot easier to do that via trade these days than people leaving. It's hard to replace them.
Yeah. No, that makes all the sense in the world. And I think just kind of zooming out with the extension, as again, the rookie scale deadline is passed at this point. I think the biggest name that didn't receive an extension before Monday's deadline was Jonathan Kuminga. We talked about Moses Moody on the last pod. So big season ahead for him. But other than that, again, congratulations to everyone getting their money. Quick injury update for New Orleans, at least. Pelicans guard DeJounte Murray feared to have a fractured hand. He's out indefinitely from Shams Charania of ESPN. And Pelicans wing Trey Murphy III still out with the right hamstring strain, out at least 2 more weeks. He'll be reevaluated in 2 weeks. So the Pelicans without both DeJounte and Trey Murphy III right now. But as we record on a Thursday, we've gotten a couple of days of regular season basketball. Steve, we can give some quick takeaways, some things that we've seen. Any teams or players in general that you want to shout out? What caught your eye over the first 48 hours of NBA hoop?
Basketball did.
Ah, I see. Shout out basketball. Favorite sport, like the way they dribble, et cetera.
The Boston Celtics hit a lot of threes and are very good at basketball, and you got to deal with them. The New York Knicks... Actually, you know what? I'll take it off the Knicks. Defense is interesting right now, in an interesting position. You can tell the season is just starting. A lot of closeouts or attempted closeouts, some overhelping, some rotating, some scrambling. So we'll monitor that as it goes on. The Lakers did some really good things. Anthony Davis was really fun to watch in that first game. I liked just the overall concept of, one, let's keep you very aggressive. let's keep you in that mindset. But two, let's move you around the board offensively. So let's get you an elbow catch. Let's run inverted pick and roll out of that. Let's get you in movement into a post up. Let's just use you in different ways, which I think is going to get the best version of him. And I think for the Lakers overall, you kind of see, okay, if we find something that works, we're going to run it again. We're not in the position where it has to be LeBron throwing his fastball all the time. Mm-hmm. We have enough that where our guards can be involved. AD can be a hub. AD can attack. We can use that as a pressure point, and we can mix LeBron in. Like, obviously, he's still LeBron, but it has a different feel, a better feel. I was also intrigued defensively as far as the Lakers being able to switch and Anthony Davis doing multiple things defensively. Might be in a drop. Might show out. Might be at the level. Might switch. Can't necessarily get a hand on it. That'll be interesting. Minnesota, it's going to take a little bit of time. I'm intrigued by their rotation. Their lineup versatility should be fun. Having wings is good. I think this is a team that's going to need to figure out how to flow into the next actions. But being able to do multiple things, have more lines for Anthony Edwards to play around with, being able to mix and match the bigs, I think Julius Randle attacking switches is going to, you know, his force on drives will force teams to show help, which will help Minnesota a little bit with that. I think the decision-making has to be a little bit quicker. But overall, I think they don't quite have the same flow they had last year, so that's going to take a little bit of time. The Pistons are fun, guys.
They are.
Kate Cunningham, pretty fun. So no surprise they're competing. I'm trying to avoid the Nikias division here since I'm going first. So there are about 19 teams. You know, Torian Prince and Gary Trent Jr., I'm intrigued by them defensively from Milwaukee, especially Gary Trent Jr. at the point of attack, navigating screens. Just brings a level of juice to them that I think is important. Like, obviously, that won't be the starting lineup, but to have, like, those two as options is pretty fun. I can't talk about Evan Mobley. Can't talk about the Hornets. Brandon Ingram. Still pretty good at basketball.
There we go.
So, you know, I know how you feel about the Pelicans. Ja Morant's back.
Brother, really his fourth quarter against Utah.
Really fun to watch him in pick and roll. I'll put it that way. The Intuit Dome is fun.
I like you like the wall.
Yeah, I like the atmosphere. It's loud, noisy. It was good times. Warriors are very deep. That's all I got off the top of my head. We can go band for band if you'd like.
That's crazy. I guess I'll quickly add to the Brandon Miller portion. I think it was a hip contusion for him in that Rockets game, so I should have had him in the injury report session with the Pelicans. Haven't gotten the official update on how long he may be out. Hopefully it's just a day-to-day thing, but we'll toss his name in the ring there. I guess just bouncing back to the Tuesday sleep very quickly, Boston was probably the worst possible team that the Knicks could have gotten to start the season, as they are obviously still trying to work out kinks with Karl-Anthony Towns. How do we want to get him touches? How do we want to defend with him? How many coverages are we comfortable with him being in, at least to start the season? I think they want to get to a point to where the drop works, him at the level works. I don't know how often they'll switch him, but I mean, there is some switch and double potential there with New York, depending on who the opponent is. But you get a team like Boston that just spreads you out the way that they do. They're able to generate paint touches. They're able to generate a whole bunch of threes. And then defensively, hey, Drew Holiday, here's Karl-Anthony Towns. Just go guard him. Let's turn some of those potential pick and rolls into switches. Also, because he's Drew, he can also bump out some of these catches. It was just a really unfortunate matchup for the New York Knicks, and a super impressive day one victory for the Celtics. So I want to give them their props there.
Oh, that's a question real quick to bounce off that.
Yeah.
So the Jason Tatum pull-ups, how do you feel about it?
Well, if they're going again to the degree that they were against the Knicks, good luck to the rest of the league. But in general, like, there was a level of decisiveness with it. Like, okay, cool. Cat's in a drop. Let's go just basic high pick and roll. We'll set the screen near the hash if necessary. We'll set a screen near half court. Let's see what you do. Hey, let's run Spain pick and roll. Let's get into some window dressing before flowing into Spain pick and roll. Oh, there's a pocket of space. Jason Tatum just chews it up. One or two dribbles. Goes right up. The form does look a little bit more refined. That seems to be like the video Twitter thing that stood out the most with Jason Tatum in that jumper. And we saw it in the preseason. Like, I floated out the take. It was a very 10-second take when we're talking about preseason stuff. Like, hey, Jason Tatum shot 39% from three on volume, and the jumper does look smoother. And so if that's a real thing, and it's not just Tatum can get hot at any given time with the pull-up, and it's now just Jason Tatum is indeed the pull-up three-point shooter, as we've seen before. But if that's just his level now, is switching just the default against Boston on a high level? Not that it will work, but what other coverage would you be comfortable in against this group and against Jason Tatum in particular if he is just taking that off the board to that degree? Because he's historically been good against drop coverage. But if he's that as a pull-up shooter on top of the playmaking growth that we've seen, the drives getting better and more frequent for him, him being able to draw fouls at a higher level, like he just becomes a totally different dude if that's just his level. So I like the pull-ups. I like that he hunted those out, but also still mixed in enough drives to where it didn't feel like it was jumper heavy for him. So I did like the balance there. He's got to keep that.
I'll say to bounce off of your, you don't want to play Boston to start the season. They're a known quantity. Mm-hmm. They know who they are on both ends of the floor. And defensively, they're very good with great defenders, which is not ideal if you're trying to figure out or find your way or understand what makes you good as a unit and run through that, because they can tilt matchups. They can show help. Gaps can change. So I wouldn't necessarily put the whole judgment on the Knicks right now. Mm-hmm. Actually, you know what? That'll spawn a question. How many teams do you feel like you know pretty well right now?
I guess just in the East, Boston, Miami, slight derogatory, but I guess we'll get to that a little bit later in the show. One of the mailbag questions that we got. Okay. OKC, you know how I get with the Heat during the regular season.
So oh, I'm well that's aware. Nothing new. I'm well
yeah,
aware.
That's, yeah. Yeah, long-term dunkers know what it is. But no, the Thunder, the Magic. I'm trying to think of teams that just didn't change all that much. Those are four off the top of my head at the very least. But to your overall point, like there has been a lot of movement. It is going to take some time for these teams to gel. Whether it's new personnel altogether or new coaching or new points of emphasis, like with Cleveland in particular, like there wasn't drastic roster changes, but what would the tempo look like? How would the usage kind of vary with Darius Garland fully back in the fold? Are they going more with Evan Mobley? We'll talk about that a little bit, but yeah, there's a lot of things to parse through right now.
Okay, where else are you taking us? Are you gonna do the are you gonna do the Cleveland Evan Mobley thing?
You know, while we're here, we can do the Cleveland Evan Mobley thing as Steve begins to sigh. He's going to get some water, et cetera. But no, in all seriousness, heck of a win for the Cleveland Cavaliers. I also have Toronto thoughts. We'll get to those shortly. Evan Mobley, early offense attacker, is something that caught my eye almost immediately when going through that game earlier today. Grab a defensive rebound. Evan Mobley brings it up, not to just to flow into a handoff with someone, but hey, I can just get all the way downhill. Or let me receive a screen from insert guard here, and let's see if you switch or see if you show. And then I can also attack after that if necessary. And just the overall flow for Cleveland felt really good offensively. Like Darius Garland wasn't knocking down all of his shots early, but he was hunting pull-ups, hunting drives. Like he was very decisive and aggressive in that game. Donovan Mitchell, I still don't understand how he finishes some of the things that he does. Shout out to the second quarter zone for Cleveland with Donovan Mitchell just kind of in the middle. That was fun. They switched a whole lot against Toronto. And so on one hand, I'm like, is this something that they're going to trust a little bit more with their collective size? Again, Dean Wade healthy now, so you just have a level of size. While Max Strus is out, you can't afford to switch even more if you want to, or just show help behind it if you need to. But that also flows into the Toronto question of, hey, what if teams still just feel like we can just duck under certain stuff or just switch and then help off of these players that we don't think can shoot? Like, I still have a Jamal Shedd three burned in my head, I think, from the second quarter where Scottie Barnes gets a post up. They send help. And, like, if you pause in the middle of the play, it is, like, I think four of the five Cavs have at least 1 foot in the paint. As this kick out happens, I was like, oh, no. I don't want that to be the bit for Toronto. That seems a bit unfortunate to me. But no, Cleveland's defense was good. I enjoyed the usage for Evan Mobley, also the aggression, like took a couple of threes in the first quarter. So keep an eye on the 3-point volume, drained one off in the right corner, I want to say. Ty Jerome, backup point guard. Just let's go high pick and roll, get downhill, knock down a contested floater, defend it relatively well. I am still a Craig Porter Jr. truther, but if Ty Jerome's going to play like that, that backup point guard job just seems to be his. But no, impressive showing for Cleveland. I think I landed there. I almost spent 10 minutes on the game, but.
Did you have more you wanted to say? Because I'm noticing some things with you in Cleveland. The tone, the tenor is a little bit different this year with you and the Cavs. You didn't talk about their size defensively yet, or maybe you're layering that and waiting for that later. I would say for me, tempo has always been something I've talked about. I think the fact that, again, they're starting their sets earlier is big for them. Mm-hmm. The flow improved last year. No one wanted to talk about it, but the fact that they're giving you themselves to talk more about of a ch- I did, but don't nobody listen to me. The fact that they're starting earlier and now giving themselves multiple options is good. I think for me with Evan Mobley, the fun part was just the usage and like being able to let him come off some screens and him building on his growth on the perimeter last year to where I'm spaced. I'm not afraid to mix in a shot, but I will get a quick drive. I will get a drive, spin, and try and attack and finish. I'll get a drive, and maybe I'll force help and get a kick. Now, if Mobley can add that to what Cleveland does, I think it gets really dynamic, so that should be fun there. Did you want to get to your Raptors concerns, or is it just hashtag shooting?
Shooting is going to be a big part of it for me. Like, I appreciated them sprinkling in some full-court pressure, but then it was like, hey, Scotty, you pressure Caris LeVert. And I was like, well, hold on. Wait a minute. Because they almost got Evan Mobley on a turnover earlier in that game. With Scotty just pressuring Evan, like, oh, you're bringing it up. Let's see you do this against real defense then. So I'd like for them to be a little bit more selective about when they apply that. I think in the Nikaia Sicko zone, I don't know how long RJ Barrett is going to be out, but if we do actually just get a somewhat steady dose of Jamal Shedd and Davion Mitchell on the floor together, just pestering dudes, like, I'm personally going to enjoy that. The other side of the ball naturally will be an issue for spacing reasons. Or how teams feel about them on the perimeter, to be more specific. But watching those two dudes get after it defensively is pleasurable to me. So I'll give you that portion of the program. I did feel like Toronto process-wise was mostly fine, at least early in that game. Oh, they're switching a bunch. Let's get a smaller guy on Scotty Barnes. Let's space this out around him. Let's see what we can do. Again, like there was just a level of we don't care for Cleveland to where I don't know what the results are ultimately going to be. But these early on, they let's find the size mismatch. Let's have some fun. Grady Dick off ball, both in terms of the set usage and the things that Darko will draw for him, and just his comfort getting downhill. Like that was something that we talked about during summer league play, where he just felt a lot more comfortable dealing with contact and in general just getting into the paint. Like they popped early on. I want to say it was 9 or 11 points in the first quarter for him. And then there was one closeout attack, or one attack in particular. Baseline out of bounds. He curls off, gets the ball to the corner, doesn't take the shot. Really patient as he gets downhill, gets to like a little push shot. I like that for him. Emmanuel quickly inside the arc is something that I continue to keep an eye on. Felt better earlier in the game than later, which seems to be the theme of this Cavs Raptors game because the jazz music did indeed stop to close out the second quarter and particularly heading into that third quarter. It got nasty very quickly, but quickly did feel a little bit better. Inside the arc. So that is progress I would like to see him maintain. Random shout out to Chris Boucher. Toronto has some things to work out in terms of how defenses guard them. I would like to see them generate some easier stuff. And I wonder how much RJ coming back is going to change that. Just give them someone else that can generate a paint touch and maybe you can get some off-ball movement from there. Because like they generally know where they need to be spacing wise, but we shall see.
There it is.
Glad we did the thing. You want to stay in the Eastern Conference where the Orlando Magic...
Keep rolling.
The Orlando Magic looked Miami Heat in the eye and said, absolutely not. But no, really muggy basketball game that was. And it was Miami getting to the free throw line a whole lot. And Orlando trying to poke at Terry Rozier, trying to poke at Tyler Hero. Tyler Hero in particular, holding up relatively well, at least in the first half of that game, when they tried to go inverted pick and roll with Paolo, like, I will get out of here, and then I will reattach to mine. Hey, Bam, you got this. Led to a lot of contested looks, or just Orlando working deeper in the clock, so I appreciated that portion. Miami did indeed try to space more diligently around the perimeter, try to open up some driving lanes. Like, I appreciated the early rim attacks from Terry Rozier. I think my bigger picture question for Miami is how many of those guys do they have on the roster that can just get 2 feet in the paint? Like, Terry Rozier is a guy that can do it. Jimmy Butler is a guy that can do it. In light of how quiet Jimmy was offensively as a scorer, like, they're just going to need a higher volume of the drives for him to really make the offense work to punctuate things. And for Terry, he can get to the rim. How well is he going to finish? Like, that was something that I had questions about when Miami made the trade for him. Like, it helps to have a guard that can just get 2 feet in the paint with or without a screen. And that has the potential of opening up these off-ball looks for Tyler Hero and for Duncan Robinson when he's in, et cetera. But if you can't finish, like, how much are you ultimately going to bend the defenses? Because, like, Orlando, elite defense last year. And if teams don't trust that Terry's going to finish or make the right passing read if he does draw an extra defender, we don't have to sell out on these drives. And if that becomes the bit, one, how much are you bending things? And related to that, like, what exactly is the offensive ceiling of this group if you're not going to have that level of fear when Terry in particular gets downhill? But no, that third quarter was nasty work from Orlando.
Can I ask you a Miami Heat question?
You sure can.
How did you feel about the Bam Adebayo drives?
I wish there were more of them. It's kind of where I start. Like, I like the early stuff. I think he got Paolo on, like, an up fake and got to the free throw line early. So, like, it's absolutely in there. And as I mentioned, like, he was one of the players in particular that got to the line quite a bit early on. I think there's just more room for aggression with Jimmy and Bam, honestly. Like, it just felt... It was quieter than you would like. You did get 2 3-point attempts for Bam Adebayo. So if you're on 3-point watch, then that's a thing that happened, but it didn't seem to have the same flow to it. I get, honestly, one thing that popped for me on that front, I don't know how much it ultimately matters or if this is just an Orlando thing because they have a level of athleticism in their front court room anyway. But, like, I just think back to random Heat game last season when Bam's on the perimeter and Big is at the free throw line or, like, at that dotted area while Bam's on the perimeter, and then they step up as he's flowing into a handoff with someone. Like, watching Wendell Carter Jr. just kind of being up higher against him, period, it's like, huh. At least pose the thought for me, or invoke the thought for me, is that just an Orlando thing? I want to see more of that. Or is the Bam potential volume having at least some kind of inherent effect on opposing bigs? Like, do teams know, okay, he will take this? And again, it could just be an Orlando thing. And ultimately, it may not matter in terms of result. But, like, it was interesting to me just watching Wendell in particular being a little bit higher up against Bam. He was flowing at the top of the key.
I respect it. Can I ask a free throw real quick?
Sure.
Who do the Heat need to make more shots? Jovic or Terry Rozier?
Who do they need to make more shots? I think it's going to be Terry by default for me.
I'm going to offer my counter. There were quite a few possessions where the Miami Heat, it did have some good flow. Pin down, drive, force help, kick, swing, and the ball ends up in Jovic's hands, who has done a good job as a hub, has mixed in drives, but was asked to shoot threes, and it did not make them in that game. And I'm wondering if that is a hitch, or if there's maybe too much placed on him, but he's a pretty important piece of the offense really hitting its peak. Because I thought they ran some pretty good things. I thought they had the mindset to move the ball. I thought Tyler Hero was pretty decisive. But if it's going to be what they're trying to do, you kind of need the shots to fall that you create off of the drives and the ball movement.
No, I think that's fair. And, like, I guess I don't worry that much about the Jovic portion of the program. Like, to your point, the ball ended up in his hands. Like, he did take 7 threes. So, at the very least, on first watch, it didn't feel like a level of catch, hold, I don't want this. I'm turning this look down and then driving into traffic. Like, it didn't feel like a lot of those. So, I'm not super worried. And then just going back to last year, he shot 40% from three. So, I know he has the ability to knock down the shot. So, I don't ultimately think it's a bad thing if he's the one taking those shots.
Is that because of math?
Is that because of math? I guess in a literal sense, because he could shoot.
That's not Miami Heat basketball. It's not math.
Just a shout out Eric Spoelstra.
What did you think of Paolo?
That brother is large. Let's just start there. But no, appreciate him hunting on the offensive glass. Again, poked at some inverted pick and rolls. The post-ups, whenever he got, even if it wasn't inverted, whenever he got someone smaller on him, like the drive against Haywood Highsmith that just put him underneath the basket, despite him trying his very best, and Haywood is a really good defender. It's just kind of tough to deal with. Like, knowing going into a game that Paolo is just going to get to the paint, your best bet is to send some late help and see if you can disrupt him, force him into some mistakes. But him just being able to get to a spot whenever he wants is terrifying. And I think that's where there's a natural spotlight on the jumper because it's currently the weakest portion of his game. But it's also like a game changer in a sense, because he can just rise up over the top and shoot over people. You're not putting centers on Paolo. So the fact that he can just rise up whenever he wants, like, for him, he can always get a good look for himself. And so when you have the blend of drives, you add in the playmaking that we talked about last year. Whenever you do double him, he can pick things out, again, in large part because he can just see over the top of some of these doubles that you're sending at him. If the jumper is also going, and this is something that you asked me about it during the watch party last night, with him hunting some of the pull-up threes, how you feel about the balance there. But if that's something that he can just have, it's going to be incredibly tough to deal with him. To sound super cliche, but like, I don't know what you do with Paolo at that point. He is a walking mismatch to that degree. He can get to the paint against virtually anyone. He can make most passes in the book. He's comfortable taking pull-up twos, and if the three-pointer is there as well, it's just a tough bit of business. Actually, can I toss you a Paolo question?
Mm-hmm.
How'd you feel about the defense?
Felt fine. I mean, I think for me, I was more impressed with the Orlando Magic's overall team defense, the concepts of it, and their ability to, there's not a lot of mismatches that we're going to give you as a team. There's not a lot of options that you're going to have. So I wasn't that mad at it. You?
I also thought it was fine. Like, I'm trying to see more of it just because I don't know, it didn't feel like Miami put him in a ton of action. And it wasn't like you get the Jimmy assignment or anything like that. So that's just something that I want to monitor. Like, I think there's inherent value he's going to bring on the glass because of the size. And if he's able to nail the when do I peel in portion of the program, like, again, there's just a level of size and length that he can use to kind of shrink the floor and further make this Orlando defense impenetrable. So I didn't have any loud things that popped for me on film that I had in my notes. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that front. Shout out Jalen Suggs for getting hashtag activated during that third quarter run. So that was cool. Will be a good thing if Franz Wagner hits jumpers. KCP is also who I wanted to bring up. It was his Orlando Magic debut. Wasn't a heavy shot making game for him, but buddy, the defense remains insane. Quick hand, screen navigation, the help. He just felt like he was everywhere, particularly in that first half. And so if that's the defense you're getting from him, Jalen Suggs plus KCP, plus whenever Jonathan Isaac comes on the floor, they just have so much they can toss at you defensively. They are going to be an incredibly annoying team to play. Just going back to the Laker thing, I think it was saw a tweet earlier. I want to say it was from a friend of the program, Jackson Frank, that noted it was kind of comparing the difference in touches for Anthony Davis. I think it was 73.5 was his average last season. It was 89 touches in that first game, to bounce off your point about the usage for him and just the overall volume of how they ran the offense through him. If the mid-range jumper is going, then good luck dealing with Anthony Davis. But they did move him around the board quite a bit. And I think that in particular is something that's going to continue. It didn't bounce quickly off the Minnesota thing. Julius Randle and Naz Reid together and Chris Finch saying, hey, let's go zone. And I am really curious to see how often that button gets pressed, because it wasn't the best zone showing for Minnesota in those minutes. But I think in general, there is just a lack of rim protection if you're playing both of those two together. So, like, I wonder if he does settle in on, hey, let's just switch and show help and we'll do our best and we'll gain rebound, because we do have guards that don't mind mixing it up. And in particular, just kind of bouncing off of that, like, really enjoying Nikhil Alexander Walker and Dante DiVincenzo playing together. But I think that'll do it for me on Minnesota thoughts. Any other things you want to shout out?
No, let's bounce off that Minnesota thought, big dog.
Okay.
So here's the thing with the Nas Reed Julius Randle combo. The zone, really good idea. And then to let everyone know, the key to a zone, especially in the NBA, you have to stay matched up. So that Cleveland zone you were talking about earlier with Donovan in the middle, it was really just 2-3. They just kind of hybrided it, made sure they stayed matched up. Donovan, instead of just starting out the wing, you start in the middle. If they flash there, you take that. George Niang comes up, guards the wing. We stay matched up. We are not afraid to alter the shape of our zone, but that's what we do. Minnesota, on the other hand, was trying to get matched up and never successfully did, which involved Naz Reid stepping up to leave his man to guard who was in the middle with no one to help him and a calamity of errors. I think for me, when Reed and Randle are in together defensively, the biggest thing is, one, pick your coverage, two, get your help. And so it's going to take time for Randle to maybe get integrated with the rotations he's going to have to make in Minnesota. And I'm sure teams are going to be willing to force him to make those rotations in Minnesota, especially early in the season with not a lot of preseason time for Randle. So that's something you want to bookmark and monitor. Now, obviously, you can do the thing where, hey, that combo doesn't work, they can't defend, the sky is falling. Or you can be sensible and responsible and make a note of that and see if it improves over the course of the season or if it's truly a fatal flaw for the team. What a novel concept.
How about that? You notice something, you take note, and then you track its progress instead of deeming it an irredeemable failure?
I promise it's allowed.
It's pretty neat. I was going to say, on a related note to maybe not pressing the big red button, Mikal Bridges, a tale of two halves in terms of the shot making. I will raise my hand and say I don't think he's the worst wing in the world. I think we can give him time to kind of sort out the shot and ultimately just get comfortable within New York's ecosystem. But that's the thing we can do. That's on the table as an option. I honestly
asked my question on the last pod, so I'm cool.
No, you're good. No, I'll just say, honestly, if there's a Mikal Bridges thing that was concerning to me, like, very dull thing, he has to be able to make shots. If he actually just can't shoot well from three for whatever reason, that lowers his personal ceiling, that lowers the ceiling of the Knicks offense, and thus their chances against Boston if they face him in the conference finals, the second round, whatever case may be. That is just true. But like, if I'm poking at something from game one, like his screen navigation wasn't good enough against Boston. Like, with them having Cat in a drop in particular, he just has to, we've seen better from him. We have seen all defense level stuff from him. He has to reach that level in New York. I think the selling point for bringing Cat into this ecosystem is we can ask Cat to do multiple coverages. He doesn't have to be elite at them, but because he has OG Anunoby ahead of him, Mikal Bridges ahead of him, or if they're putting Jalen Brunson in action, we have those two guys behind him. We have enough structure to make this work. And so with Mikal on ball or just chasing dudes off of screens, like that part just has to be better. Like, that concerned me more than he missed open shot. Duh, he needs to knock down those open shots. And again, we get to December and he's shooting 28% from three. I'll take the L and I'll sound the alarms. But like, I think the defense has to be at a higher level than what it was. That was probably my biggest Mikal thought.
Understood.
There we go. We'll leave it there.
Also, speaking of defense, just want to salute the Los Angeles Clippers. They played a whole lot of it.
They sure did.
I don't know what it's going to mean, but they're going to defend. What's up?
Chris Dunn, brother. So you're talking about the Clipper defense. I just enjoyed it. The battle between him and KD, the KD battle between those two was cool. The Suns ultimately won. KD knocked down some big shots, but it was a battle. He made them work. Just want to salute him there. Did you want to talk about James Harden and him just poking at all of the Phoenix Sun point guards? Say, hey, you come here. Let's boogie in the middle of the floor.
I'd like to hear you talk about James Harden.
Oh, I tell you what, that brother brought it. He almost led him to the win. It just felt very, I don't want to say old school James Harden, like we didn't just see him like mismatch hunting isn't new for him. He was doing it last year. But it was he was just poking at Phoenix in a way where put the issues on Front Street. Like, this is something that they're going to have to deal with throughout the season. Like, this is something that we both talked about a little bit when they made the moves. Like, adding Tyus Jones and Monte Morris to the room should help the playmaking, should help get turnovers down. Oddly enough, just did not happen in game one. So we'll keep an eye on the turnover number for Phoenix moving forward. But just conceptually, these are guys that are going to help us get our turnover rate down. It was really bad last year. And because of their presence, they can get KD off the ball, Devin Booker off the ball, Bradley Beal off the ball, vary the usage, get them efficient looks, et cetera. But the downside was always going to be they are smaller guards and neither of them are elite defenders. We'll leave it there. And so can Phoenix kind of counteract that? And so I think it's good that Phoenix got that test early. You know, as a basketball fan, it was fun to watch James Harden just go into that kind of mode, particularly in that fourth quarter. You can't guard me. I will just get to this midi or get all the way downhill and draw fouls. And related to that, watching Kevin Durant say, actually, you know what? I'll just take James. I'll do it. You know, the basketball fan in me, I was like, I like this. I like this, KD. I zoom out. Is that a button that Phoenix wants to press all the time? And if so, like, what does that mean for the rest of the defense? Because if you are going KD at the five, as we saw towards the end of that game, if KD's now just taking on the primary assignment, what is the rim protection going to look like behind that? What is the rebounding going to look like behind that? And so maybe the Clippers couldn't completely puncture that or capitalize on that, but another team might. You know, like going cross-conference, Boston's obviously the standard right now since it's just won. Can you afford to go KD on Jason Tatum? Like, KD individually may do a solid enough job. Can you end possessions that way? Does Boston just run some fun off-ball stuff and now you can't help? Now Bradley Beal's your low man and it's like, oh, snap, what are we doing with this with KD at the top of the floor? Like, okay, it was nice for them to get that in game one, but that is not something that's on the notepad for me to track whenever they go to that smaller unit.
Did you use the best team in the league as an example?
I mean, we can go down the line. Right?
I'm only asking the important questions here. Well, I was going to ask, how'd you feel about KD pressuring full court? But apparently you were okay with it. So, I mean, you have no trust in Royce O'Neal's weak side defense?
I do. But that is inherently smaller help. That's my general point. As far as the KD full court pressure thing in particular, like a very small doses is what I would like to see on that front. Because it's not like you could just do the KD. I guess in a literal sense you can, but it's not like they do the KD thing and then Book and Bill, y'all just run the offense and KD used to take a bunch of catch shoot opportunities. Like they ran a lot of offense through KD still. So just managing the burden for him on both ends. And as this is an 82 game season, like those are things I want to have in the bag. Those aren't things that I want to be doing all regular season long, if that makes sense.
Well, I think it's a plus they had it in the bag.
Yeah.
I think it'll be interesting to see how the Clippers approach team switching against them going forward. So I imagine they'll get their dose. They have their lineups they can get to, but are they going to continue to play through their offense? Or are they going to try and settle in on attacking mismatches and kind of bogging themselves down in a way? So that's interesting.
Okay. Can I toss you, related to that, a quick Phoenix question?
What's up?
How did you feel about their shot profile?
Why would you ask me that? Why would you ask me that? I'm not the shot profile guy. That's you.
I wanted to give you some room to talk about the offense. That's all.
I like the flow in the offense they've had. They've kept that up pretty well. I think they're going to have to iron the kinks out as far as maybe balancing out what they want to run, when they want to run it, make sure everyone stays aggressive. But one of the benefits of having a Tyus Jones is just the flow you can get to in transition, where he can push, those three can cut and run in transition. You know, I think there's a play, Yusuf Nurkic was trailing, Tyus had it, KD was trailing behind Nurk. Nurk was like, hey, get the ball to KD. So instead of KD bringing it up and you're telling the whole world we're running an early drag that's going to be a high pick and roll, Tyus Jones has it, quick swing, there's Nurk. Now we can cook out of that. So some of the pressure points they can hit to where we don't necessarily have to, we can mix in some of the spacing, but we can put Booker and Beal over in the on the same side together. We can run pick and roll. We have Nurkic, we have Plumlee. Defense helps, we kick. Now you're in rotation. We've got players that can punish you. I think for me, it's just making sure that they keep the flow up and random doesn't just truly mean random and they don't bog themselves down. But as far as the shot profile, I'm probably more encouraged by the ability to get to the free throw line than the fact that maybe they shot more threes, because that's kind of your bag.
Fair enough. For cleaning the glass.
No. Before you get to cleaning glass, the Clippers only shot 29 threes. They shot 92 shots for the game. They almost won. I just want people to know that. Don't fall for the hype.
Okay, there you go. Don't fall from the hype.
What's the clean the glass tag? Give it to me.
No, I was just going to say to bounce off of the number there. Just roughly 44% of their shots were threes in that game against the Clippers. I think league wide for everyone that's played right now, anyway, a 6th in 3-point rate, 11th in mid range rate.
Okay, so okay. You know what? Let's do this right now. Who's second in 3-point rate?
Second and 3-point rate, the Golden State Warriors.
Who's third?
The Minnesota Timberwolves.
They lost. Who's fourth?
The Orlando Magic.
That's not real. Who's fifth?
The Memphis Grizzlies.
Oh, that's interesting. Who's sixth?
How about that? Sixth would be Phoenix.
Seven?
Seventh was Brooklyn. Which makes sense that they got a lot of threes up.
Who's eighth?
Eighth would be the Milwaukee Bucks.
Now wait a minute, they took less than 50%. Okay, it's fine. Who's after them?
Charlotte. And to be clear, this is just the percentage of shots that were threes for the listeners.
Who's the next one? Who's the last one?
The next one was Miami.
Interesting. All right, cool.
And that is cleaning the glass with Nikias and Steve. We did it. Haven't finished Sixers Bucks yet, so don't have super deep thoughts there. I will say the early slips for Giannis were cool, and just him and Dame operating together, that just seems to be even more dangerous. And like, it's funny, we talked about them building chemistry last year and it wasn't perfect, but then you look at the pick and roll numbers, it's like, oh well, this is just 1.1 points per possession. They're just one of the most effective pick and roll duos in the league by the numbers and stuff. And so the fact that at least the early goings, again, I'll finish that game, maybe I feel differently, but nice that it's starting to feel like what the numbers were last year, or at least nice to reinforce that, rather. Kind of early thought there. Also, just KJ Martin fighting for his life against Giannis is kind of unfair to him. But ultimately, hope the Sixers are able to get healthy. That's going to be a big thing there. And also, just a general shout out to Brooke Lopez, who just continues to be masterful in a drop. Quick salute to Trey Mann. Big road win to kick off the season for Charles Lee and the Charlotte Hornets. Grant Williams hitting big threes. LaMelo Ball, offensive monster. Again, get well soon to Brandon Miller, but also had one of the most explosive dunks of the night on Wednesday. So quick shouts there. Grudgingly keeping an eye on Charlotte's big man room as Mark Williams isn't back yet. And so they are cycling through some hashtag options. I think they're going to end up trending smaller than they would like, especially if Nick Richards just can't hold up for some reason. Some really weird defensive possessions for him in that game. But quick salute to the Charlotte Hornets. Any other players or teams you want to shout out before we move?
I'm intrigued that you went with a quick salute to the Charlotte Hornets this deep into the podcast. I was expecting it to come a little bit earlier and be a little bit louder, but I understand. Now we're good. We can move on.
All right. With that, we will then dip into the mailbag. Once again, thank you to those who sent in questions. If you ever have basketball thoughts on the NBA or the WNBA side, email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. That is dunkerspot@yahoo.com. Our first question is going to come from a watch party favorite. Shout out Dante/Don Tizzle, who says, "Hi guys, it's Dante/Tizzle asking who the Chicago Sky should be looking to replace Teaspoon with. As I've said during watch parties, I'm still upset with the fact that she's gone in the first place, but what's done is done. Now that there's 5 vacancies in the league, it's probably time to figure out who will become the leader for the next era of Sky basketball. So I asked who would get the most out of the team. Thank you for all you all do for me and helping me get through a rough summer. Okay, bye."
Thank you for the question. There's a important part of this, and it's something that made me, I thought about with these vacancies. A lot of teams are believing in the options that they have. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there's some left field options that no one's ever thought about. So I don't necessarily know who is the best person to lead this team. Secondarily, I don't necessarily know what this team is going to be next year. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to necessarily poke at one person, because I think the personnel has to be better overall. Not that they didn't have talent on that team. I don't know if the talent blended itself together. So if this is a team that has more shooting or has more versatility or has more playmaking, I think that can shift who it is. I think it has to be someone who can get the most out of your young talent, your young core. You need to be able to have that buy-in and that belief to get the most of that team. But I don't necessarily have a particular name that will stand out, because this team might look completely different very soon.
Yeah, like I think, you know, mentioned earlier in the pod, like they are one of the teams that has been linked to Stephanie White if she does leave Connecticut. Now, granted, the Fever also have been connected to Stephanie White. And I would imagine if Stephanie does leave Connecticut, I would imagine the Fever would just have the leg up there, if for no other reason than because she's been there before. So I don't know how realistic that will ultimately be for Chicago. I'm with you. Like, I don't know if I have many specific names that I'm at least comfortable tossing out. I'll put it that way. There's a couple of names that come top of mind for me, but again, don't want to do that on this podcast. More than anything, though, I think the personnel additions may be a little bit more important than the coaching ad. Not that it's not going to be important, because you need to have the right leader, you need to have the right tactical mind, et cetera. But because the offense in particular was so hamstrung by the lack of shooting, and we got the Marina Mabry trade in the middle of the season on top of that, like that needs to be addressed before I can even get into more stylistic things. Cause like, toss this out here. Like, if we're saying we think Angel Reese and Camilla Cardoso are our future, we want to build around these two bigs. Like, Kurt Miller has experience dealing with a multi-big system. So like, that seems like a natural fit on the surface, but I can't go deeper than that, because as great of a mind as Kurt Miller is, if you can literally put all five of your defenders around the free throw line or lower against the team, like, his creativity is only going to go so far. You know what I mean? And so, like, I will just say, like, Kurt Miller with the locker room, just that seems like a lot of fun potential, like legit just fun with the group players that just guys do have. I think they would gel well. But yeah, like, I need to see them add to that room. And we have an entire draft lotteries next month. We have free agency, et cetera. So they'll have time to attempt to address it. But I'm more focused in on how do you space this out? How do you open up more room with the on-court personnel to make life easier for Camilla and Angel? I think from there, it'll be easier for insert Coach X to install actual system and maybe move Angel around in a different way, or maybe utilize Camilla more as a high post hub, et cetera, et cetera. Again, like, these can all be Kurt Miller things in particular, just throw a name out there. But I think I'm more focused on the personnel right now. Next question going to come from Shakur. I'm sorry if I'm saying that incorrectly. You do have permission to yell at me if necessary, but we have an Aces question. Who says no to a sign and trade? And they propose Kelsey Plum for Satu Sabally. Vegas can use more size without sacrificing versatility. Arike and KP can do their Steve Francis, Coutinho, Mobley thing. Plum may not want out in a she's unhappy sense, but her being the only one of the core four who went to the end of her contract probably means something. If not that sign and trade, can you think of any that you would like? Or what might you like to see Vegas do? Not necessarily what you think they will do. Alicia Clark is almost 40. Tiffany Hayes is 35. If she doesn't retire again and wants to resign, Chelsea will be 33 during next season, and KP will turn 31. If not this offseason, a non-Asia Jackie roster shakeup seems inevitable sooner than later. Well, one, on a very basic level, I would just have to see like how double sign and trades work in the W. Like, that just isn't something I'm super privy to compared to the NBA side. Because Satu and Kelsey are technically both unrestricted free agents, and I also would imagine that their respective teams just core them before anything happens.
That man brought the logics to the hypothetical.
I just want to make sure I am as thorough as I can be. So the hypothetical itself, like, I would think the Wings would say no. Why? If that's just the deal. Because I don't know if they want to downsize in light of what the rest of the defense is right now. It's less about like Kelsey as a talent, because I think her and Arike could just be one of the most, if not the most prolific backcourt in basketball. But it's more defensive foundation of Arike plus Kelsey plus, if Tierra McCallum's still there, she's there. If she's moved on, then it's Kalani Brown at the five, or if they make another move, Natasha Howard's already going to be gone. So they would just have to fill more holes in the wing slash forward room to really make that work. And I think with Vegas, like, that feels you miss Kelsey shooting and, like, the way teams treat her as a shooter more than anything, because Satu did shoot well from three this year. But, like, you miss that kind of threat. But in light of some of the size concerns that popped up throughout the postseason, or particularly that Liberty series, like, I think they'd be more amenable to, hey, Satu, you just add a level of size to our wing room. We now slot Jackie Young legitimately at the two alongside Chelsea. And you feel a little bit better about that. So I would think the Wings would say no before the Aces would.
I'm going to go devil's advocate. I'm going to say the Aces hit the red button on the phone. We got revenge on our mind.
You know what? Fair.
Let's hit the margins. Let's get some more versatility. Try to add some more shooting, some playmaking. Y'all going to have to deal with this next year.
I like it. And then related to that, I really do think there will be a point where the Aces will have to add more size and youth and overall athleticism to the roster. Like, I don't think it needs to be it's certainly not going to be a rebuild unless something drastic happens behind the scenes or something like that. But even to the retool portion, if it is like Kelsey going elsewhere, et cetera, like, I don't think that happens this year. I think it's more, let's add another depth piece that can help complete some of these lineups. Like, if I had to guess, if they are hunting out trades, again, no reporting anything. We are dealing in hypotheticals here, to be very clear. But, like, I think it's more likely that the Aces, like, call the Sparks and say, hey, what would y'all want for Azaree Stevens? I think that feels more realistic than let's swing for the fences, let's use Kelsey as a piece to trade and bring another star in. I think they look for a front court compliment or try to find a younger, sticking with the Sparks. Like, let's find our own version of Ray Burrell that has shown flashes but hasn't caught on yet. And then they enter our rotation and holy crap, they needed that infusion of wing defense and shooting and drive, et cetera, et cetera. Like, I think they try to do that versus a drastic retooling of it around the core, at least this season. And so for you, it would just be more margin things for the Aces. That's what you're looking for on that front?
For me, yeah.
Okay. Makes sense. I think broader picture, it wouldn't surprise me. As you mentioned, like, Chelsea turning 33, KP turned 31. Like, they're still all W caliber players. At least the healthy versions of them are. But yeah, like, they are, like, technically different age timelines than Asia and Jackie. So I wouldn't be surprised if 2026, 2027, the core four is no more. Like, that wouldn't shock me. But I don't think that is a this offseason thing, if I had to guess. Okay, without further comment, we can move to Carlton's question, who says, hi guys, huge fan of the pod and you both individually. Thank you. My question is about the Knicks and their long-term offense. Who generates easy buckets for them and how do they come? Obviously, you have Jalen Brunson, who can collapse the defense, but watching the first game against Boston, albeit against an elite defense, they seem to lack a creator who could get the defense to react in any way besides Brunson. Cat, OG, and Mikhail all do their best work from beyond the arc, and while Cat can post up, I don't know how many of those it would take to make a defense adjust and start doubling him down there. Just wondering how they generate easy looks as the season goes along. The most underrated part about Julius Randle, in my opinion, has always been his driving ability, and I think the Knicks may sorely miss that as the season goes on. Appreciate any thoughts you have. Would love to be able to give my dad some hope as he's reeling after this first game.
Well, thank you for the question, Carlton. I apologize that your pops is reeling. We're going to try and give him a little bit of hope. One, the Boston Celtics, again, probably the worst team that they could have faced because that pressure point, the stir of the beverage, so to speak, Jalen Brunson was dealing with a team who felt like a whole bunch of people on that court could guard him, and they felt like a whole bunch of people on that court guard Cat, and they could put Al Horford on Josh Hart. So right off the bat, we're in a distorted world for a unit that's trying to find themselves. I think the biggest thing, hopefully I'm addressing the question, but to bounce off of it, for New York, it's establishing an offensive base. Like, let's take Jalen Brunson off the board for a moment, because I think it's obvious what he can do, what he can create, how defenses react, et cetera, et cetera. You need to be able to have movement and a mixture of things to where OG Anunoby is not just space in the corner. He's slicing off screens, getting post touches. He's in dribble handoffs. You need Mikal Bridges to be able to come off screens and maybe not necessarily shoot, but hey, we've got some movement. Get a drive and kick. mixing some post-ups, cat at the elbow. Do we have off-ball movement around that? You have to use your personnel together to kind of create some of that. It's going to take time. You know, are the cat elbow touches going to be for a set? Are they going to be for him to drive? Are they going to be handoffs? Like, what are you going to build your base out of so that you have all of these people going at the same time, so it's not just Jalen Brunson? You know, you can put a lot of them in action together. And even in that game, you know, the Knicks called timeout. Now it's OG Anunoby and Josh Hart in action together. That's an encouraging sign because, hey, we're going to put that ball in multiple people's hands. It's not just going to be Jalen Brunson. So I think that has to be the mission for the Knicks this season. Is obviously, you know, it's going to help when they are able to get stops and not facing a team that is making almost a record-setting amount of three-pointers and forcing you to take the ball at the net. But I think I think number one is establishing that base so it's not just, okay, Bridges has to make these threes or has to beat this matchup or we're watching each other go one-on-one or taking turns.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think, one, to try to alleviate some of the angst from our dear dad listener here. Do you know what New York's offensive rating was in that game against Boston?
What was it?
A 124.1.
Is that good?
That mark, if extrapolated across the entire season, would have been easily the highest offensive rating in NBA history. So part of the angst is, again, naturally, Boston had a historic three-point shooting game, a historic offensive game. And to that point, at 164.6 offensive rating, it's just that is video game stuff, et cetera. I think to the broader question about, like, who can generate advantages, et cetera, naturally, you want that to be Cat. Like, this is why you trade for him. Let's open up the floor for Jalen Brunson, but also he can do so many different things and he can break defenses in his own way. I think the biggest thing I would take away from that Boston matchup as they cross-matched the way that they did, again, Drew Holiday getting the Cat matchup, Josh Hart, get ready to see a whole bunch of Al Horford or insert Bink here so we can just keep someone near the basket. I kind of go back to our season preview. I think I floated out, like, hey, like, what is their best five or who should they start? Is it worth bringing Josh Hart off the bench? Would be like one of the early questions that I have. Can still close, obviously still important to the team. But like,
can I raise a hand? I'm sorry. Who do you start?
Sure. I mean, that would be your issue. Like, is it worth giving Deuce the look?
Seth, who brings the scoring punch off the bench?
Well, they're still staggering, et cetera. So, like, you can still configure the lineup a different way. Like, to that point, you're still bringing Josh Hart, who can initiate some. You have campaign. And if you are having, you know, if it's Jalen plus second unit, if it's you just added Mikhail in, if it's going to be Mikhail plus other things off the bench for these hybrid second units, like, I think there are ways you can configure it. But I think base level question for me is, like, is it worth making, like, the Josh for Deuce swap or Josh for someone swap? Just in an attempt to get the center on Josh Hart thing off the table. No. I think the best version of Cat offensively is when he's being defended by fives. You can open up the full breadth of Cat can roll, Cat can pop. We can run cross game for Cat and make this big navigate, et cetera. I think the big thing for Boston, again, they're the best team in the league and not everyone can do this, but the fact that we can put non-center on Cat means we can turn a whole lot of this stuff into switches. And because we have big on Josh Hart, we can keep a presence at the rim without having to over-rotate elsewhere. And I just wonder if that's, again, Boston's probably the only team that could do it to this level. But I would worry for New York if other teams treat that as a template that they could tap into more of.
Why? Did they not, teams not try it last year?
With Minnesota, yeah.
No, but I mean, Josh Hart in general?
Putting big on Josh Hart.
He's been defended in different ways. So I don't know if I would start Deuce McBride and alter your team that way. Now you have to go to Jalen Brunson to start the second quarter. You know what I mean? I think you stick it out and figure it out. So that way now Deuce can play with more of those starters in the stagger than the reverse. Now it's Jalen having to play with the bench because they don't have the depth right now. You know what I mean? I think if this is last year's team, maybe I would get it. But like, I don't necessarily see it this year. You know, I don't think Josh Hart's a liability and Boston just put him in a tough spot. But I would much rather they focus and prioritize on getting things going from side to side, setting screens and opening things up for each other than swapping Josh Hart out.
I got you. I guess it's more like conceptual for me. Like, I don't want Cat to be an auto switch. If we were just thinking general, who draws to or who, again, like who bends defense at a basic level.
I mean, you can't take it off the table. You just have to beat it. Honestly, nothing's going to stop any of these playoff teams from saying, hey, Cat, you're a switch. Unless they just absolutely don't have the size. And maybe you're a switch with everyone but one person, or we switch and scram. It's like, you can't line up your way out of a team's decision to do that.
Gotcha.
You either have to beat it or have more counters for it. But like, if the Pacers decide, you know what, we're just going to switch, which I don't think they would, but you got to live with it.
No, that's fair.
Either play them out of it or keep doing what you do.
I guess more accurately be like, can you minimize the usage that teams may go to with that gambit versus eliminate it off the table? Because to your point, like, no, I don't think you can completely remove a switch off the table.
It's all about being timely and punishing defenses for their decisions. That's the biggest thing you got to realize in this process world that we live in. And I love the process. Talk about the process. But if you have to punish a team at the right moment to make them blink, that's what all this is about. Hey, you know, in that Boston-New York game, Al Horford was guarded by campaign. Boston throws it into Al Horford. The Knicks double. He survived. Did it take it off the table? Did it make Boston want to throw it into Al more? I don't know. Phoenix Clippers, we're switching everything. Zubac, you get Ty Jones. You get a smaller player. We're going to live with it. Didn't necessarily get the result for the Clippers that made Phoenix do anything different. Matter of fact, I think, you got an offensive foul, something else happened. So because of that, we didn't take that off the table because we didn't hit you when we needed to. It's an ebb and flow. It's an ebb and flow. Same time when volume scores take some of these shots, and it's like, oh my God, is that the shot profile they want? They want to take those shots? Well, if they make that, you got to react as a defense eventually. That Lakers-Wolves game, Anthony Edwards might look like it'd be time to cook. Lakers say, nope, we're going to double. Pass, 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 score, score, score. We're not doing that anymore. That's, you know what I mean? You have to be able to have a versatility and react.
So I guess related to that then, because I think that's fair. Related to that, I wonder what the threshold is for the Cat post-ups in particular. Actually, we can get the numbers on that right now. But I guess just thinking through it in real time, like naturally you want to take the switching off the table, but just in general, like it wasn't always a switch for Boston. It was just, hey, here's Drew. This is just it. As y'all walk up the court, this is just the matchup. And like Cat did have some early success on the block, but like to the question point, like you didn't see a heavy dose of doubles for Cat. Like I think Boston was largely okay with, hey, if he makes this, then cool. If he misses, even better. I think I think Zach Lowe pointed out on his Twitter feed after the game or the morning after the game, like, oh, Cat only took 2 threes in that game. It's like, well, you don't want to lose that portion of the program for him. The second spectrum has him at 4 post-ups and 1.5 points per possession on those post-ups.
Is that good?
That is very good. Okay. But granted, it's only 4, so. I don't know. Like, that's an interesting balance that New York will have to find as well. Like, if teams are going to stash guys on Cat, like, okay, we do have to work to counter that, to your point, without losing the essence of what our offense is or without it just turning into this the Cat show. And losing the overall flow. And ultimately, again, it's one game that we've seen in the regular season at the very least. And like limited preseason reps. To get back to the heart of the question, you nor your father should be pressing the big red button on the Knicks and their offense. Like they still scored at an efficient rate. Like the defense was a much bigger problem than the offense was in that game. And I think facing non-Boston opponents, you may see you'll get a clearer vision of what the Knicks offense can be. What they try to get to, what kind of advantages they could create, how defenses react to that against non-Boston teams. Boston is still the standard. Ultimately, you probably don't get to the finals without facing them in some capacity. this year if everyone's healthy. So you do have to find answers against them specifically. But to the overall, can we generate good stuff? Like, New York was, again, able to score the division clip at the very least. And not everyone is Boston, nor do they have their same personnel or the level of scheme versatility that they do. So you may just see better. So don't worry too much, at least not right now. Did you have any closing Knicks thoughts or questions to bounce off of?
No, we're good.
Okay. I like that question. Next one going to come from Tej, who says, Scotty Barnes did not look good in yesterday's game. The team as a whole looked bad, honestly, but as the front office has decided to rally around Scotty, he is the focal point. Is it time to worry that he's not going to develop into a star caliber talent that can lead the team to compete, or are we as fans worrying a little early? Trying to embrace the bounce if only the Raptors didn't make it so difficult.
What do you think? You are our Scotty Barnes expert.
Our Scotty Barnes expert. That is amazing. Of the two person panel on this podcast. But
yeah,
that tracks. No, it's not time to worry that he's not going to develop into a star caliber talent that can lead the team to compete. I do think that Cleveland was very comfortable switching against Scotty Barnes. And more importantly, they were comfortable switching and then showing help against those switches with Scotty Barnes. I don't know, barring like drastic developmental case or drastic trade, if they are actually pushing for like a playoff spot this year. I don't know if that changes in a major degree because of the overall shooting talent on the roster. I don't know if that's a Scotty deal. You know what I mean? Like, that's more of a general, Toronto may not have a high enough offensive ceiling because of the shooting portion. So I don't know if I can get to Scotty concerns yet. Like, the closest I can get is, like, if the context is this, like, does he develop bad habits? But, like, I don't foresee that, really. Or at least nothing that popped up in game one against Cleveland. But, again, I did think Toronto was ultimately diligent about, hey, they are switching. Let's get Donovan in action. Let's get Darius in action. Let's have you attack. Like, there was a two-play sequence in that first quarter, I want to say, where got a bucket, had a miss, but it was a pretty quick decision to attack once he got the ball in the middle of the floor. And there was also the corner dot to, I want to say, Chris Boucher, when they did send a double. So it's not like he doesn't still see the floor well, etc. I don't think it was an A-plus game for him last night, but I didn't see anything offensively to where I was like, ooh, this may be problematic moving forward.
I think the most interesting thing from that game was the comfort they had with Darius Garland and Donovan Mitchell just guarding him.
Yeah.
From a game plan perspective, what you want to see is, how does he handle teams treating him a certain way? Will teams treat him a certain way? Does it change how they view him? You know, I think the talent is there. We've seen him grow. Obviously, it's going to be highlighted and looked at a little bit more with this version of the Raptors. But if the defense is saying, we believe we're okay if you have this matchup or you're doing this, puts you in a tough spot. Now, again, how much movement did the Raptors have in that first quarter? Didn't really feel like it was Scotty heavy to start the game. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I thought he looked pretty good in the preseason. It's just one of those things where I wouldn't necessarily hit the panic button. These things, it takes time to grow these things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Look at how far Paolo came. People didn't think he could do what he did in the playoffs, and now Orlando is saying, you know what, let's just attack matchups, buddy.
You know? Let's just keep doing that, yeah.
And so he's added and grown, and Scotty Barnes got to add and grow. It'll just be interesting to see how Toronto decides to build the boat, because they are so key on trying to have this movement and trying to use their talent together and embrace Scotty's versatility. Versus every play is made by Scotty Barnes.
Yeah. I think that is very well said. I don't think I have anything else on the Toronto front. I talked about the game. Ultimately, I think Scotty's going to be all right. Next question going to come from Parker, who says, hi, Nikaiza Steve. Love the pod and all the great work you do. Thank you. I know Khalil Ware is not ready to be an impact player. Particularly his work as a screener is atrocious. But is he really that much worse than Thomas Bryant? There is absolutely no reason he should be employed by an NBA team, and it kind of feels like that he should be prioritized in the future instead of focusing on winning right now. Do you think they reprioritize their focus at any point during the season and give their young players more run?
I got to earn on given. Heat culture, earned, not given.
Yep.
You got to earn those minutes. You get the opportunity and you show what you can do, you'll earn more minutes. If that opportunity doesn't come, guess what? You got to wait.
Yeah, I don't know if, especially based on how the preseason rotation shook out, Khalil's probably further away than fans would like to admit. Even I would say on a base level, I probably agree. Like, I would just rather see Khalil Ware get the reps versus Thomas Bryant. But understanding how the Heat operate, like, Steve's absolutely right. Like, no, he's not getting those minutes until he earns it, or I guess, and or we get the Heat string of injuries that we just normally always get with the group. But all things equal, like, he's not getting that opportunity until he shows the coaching staff what they need to see. And ultimately, to the Orlando game, like, I don't think we see that dose of Thomas Bryant anyway if Kevin Love wasn't a late-ish scratch for that game. So ultimately, like, you may just not see Thomas or Khalil Ware if Kevin Love is healthy and if the game isn't a blowout, and thus you naturally is going to see a lot more Bam on top of that. Or if you don't work, yeah. So, like, I'm with you on Ware over Bryant. I don't think we see it. To the second part of the question, I just don't think that he'd do that. Should they, is a different conversation that I'd be willing to entertain. But ultimately, Nick, no. This is, we have a large enough sample that the Heat are not going to just say, hey, we're punting on XYZ. These starters are getting 27 minutes max, and here comes Pell Larson and Khalil Ware, et cetera, et cetera. Like, I don't think we get that. Like, the young players that are in the rotation is Hero, Jovic, and Jaime. And that's because they are some of the best players they have on the team. Like, I don't think we get, like, a full-blown reorient. I don't think they're going to fully reorient things. I think going even further with that, like, that feels like that would just be Jimmy Butler focused, considering he's in a contract year. But again, like, the Heat generally don't have the appetite to do that kind of thing. So I wouldn't hold my breath on that front. Did you have anything else to add on the Heat front?
No.
All righty. We then move to our next question. This one coming from Don Javis, dear Watch Party pal. Hi, Nikias and Steve. Big fan of all that you guys do. Please help me not freak out about the Sixers. Obviously, when this team is fully healthy, I believe they can compete with and beat anyone.
Stop. I'm more worried about... Stop. Oh. If you like to not freak out, just read your own words. That sentence over and over again. Just affirmations.
It's just affirmations.
All right, continue.
Well, when you put it that way, I don't know if I need to now. But I'm more worried about what the team will look like when Embiid isn't there, which will be one of the two nights of every back-to-back at the very least. And now it also includes the first week of the season.
Wait, can I raise my hand?
Yeah, what's up?
Do we have confirmation that Joel Embiid is not playing back-to-backs, or he just say, I don't think I will be?
I think it's that plus Daryl Morey had the comments in that Tim Bontemps piece.
Okay. Like, I mean, it's continue. Sorry.
I think it's
We're running away with this as if this is just a set in stone. Like, just continue.
Understood. But I think that's where the, like, fan angst really comes from, the fact that you got it from Embiid and Daryl Morey. But I understand the plan to keep Embiid healthy for the playoffs, and I'm on board with the load management, but can they really play two different ways and be successful? Do they not need time to gel and get on court chemistry? Can the non-Embiid Sixers led by Maxey and 35-year-old Paul George, who has played over 60 games only once since 2019, hold down the fort long enough to compete for a top three seed?
Wow. Just took PG, threw him over the top rope for no reason. 35-year-old Paul George. Well, let 37-year-old Steve try and answer this question.
And can Tyrese Maxey and this old man hold up while Embiid's out?
I don't think the issue, you want everyone to be healthy. You want to have the time to work out the kinks. It's all about the timing of it. I mean, you don't want any injuries to happen. It's a part of the game. If things get disrupted, there's no good time for your season to get disrupted. If at the start, you're missing out on key moments. If you start playing a certain way and play well, and then you have to sit and have to figure it back out, you start playing in different ways. It's tough. The thing for Philadelphia, and this is the opportunity for them with Embiid making sure to get right, and PG, unfortunately, what happened. The PG part is probably worse to a degree, because you could have integrated him and Maxey together and really, really built the base. One of the positives for Philadelphia when Embiid was out was they had to pivot offensively. We have to do X, Y, and Z. We have to find things and combinations that work for us. The larger question I have for Philadelphia is, will the small lineups work?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you have, mm-hmm. That's the biggest thing for me. Once you got Paul George, which understandably was the move to make, you had the space, you now locked yourself into, we are going to play these small lineups, unless it's maybe Yabusele at the four. You know what I mean? But we're gonna trend a little bit smaller for the most part. Can that work? Do you have enough versatility defensively to make that work? Can you get some movement and score offensively? What are the contributions from Eric Gordon? Who can Eric Gordon play with and who can Eric Gordon not play with? Which fours give you the best opportunity? Does Yabusele at the five work? How much does Andre Drummond give you? That's more important to me than necessarily the height of it. You know, who does KJ Martin play with? Which Martin do we like more? Those are the kinks they have to work out, I think. More so than just worrying about the MB portion. A lot of this conversation doesn't matter if he's not healthy, right? And so you integrate PG, you have multiple people who can do multiple things offensively. The MB package, you know, you have to work out some things defensively. But for the most part, okay, space the floor when I post up. If they double, I will pass it to you. If not, I will cook. I don't necessarily know if you need 58 games to figure that part of it out. You know what I mean? Just being honest. So I think the bigger thing for Philadelphia is, okay, it's only one game. Tyrese Maxey, 31 shots. So clearly he's ready and prepared to take this next leap. The bad news for Philadelphia, 41 made field goals, 18 assists.
Mm-hmm.
This is where, okay, are we a team that invites other teams to switch because Joel Embiid's not in the lineup? And are we ready for that? Because that's something we're going to have to deal with at some point. You don't necessarily have the topper for your team, which is both a good and bad thing. So you just got to figure it out.
Understood. And I think just to quickly bounce off of the locking into the small ball lineup type bit, even last night, you start Andre Drummond naturally with Joel Embiid out. 23 minutes without Andre Drummond on the floor, Sixers lost those minutes by 9. And the heaviest lineup in terms of usage that we saw with Andre Drummond off the floor was with Yabusele at the 5. Him, Caleb Martin, Kelly Oubre, Tyrese Maxey, and Kyle Lowry out there together in the small group. They were a minus 5 in 7 minutes. So again, one game, small sample, et cetera. But to Steve's point, they are going to have to figure that portion out in the non-Embiid games. And so I'm curious to see, like, what is that going to look like? Is that just making more shots? Do we see any kind of scheme variance defensively? Do we see more zone with Philly? Like, that, there will be some answers to parse through on that front. But they are going to have to figure that portion out. To the Don Davis question, honestly, Steve, you probably alleviated some of my concerns there. Like, just, it may not be as difficult to play off of Embiid, and thus you may not have the same threshold of we need to play 25, 30, 35, 40 games together to really build out max chemistry. Naturally, the more games, the better. But if they are able to nail just the general spacing portion of it, like, they should be okay on that front. My broader picture is just, like, I guess less about figuring things out and more like, how many losses do you stack up in these non-Embiid games? And does that just make the path more difficult for you by the time it is time for everyone to kind of ramp up together? Like, if it is just a 58 game Embiid season and he's ready to go, like, ultimately you take that. If you are now the 7th seed and we now have a play-in game and then we got late prep for the playoff series ahead, not late prep, you know what I mean? But we don't have our opponent yet. We have the play-in game, and then we flow into this playoff series, and then we got to go through this side of the bracket that may have teams that can poke at things we don't want poked at like that. Do you still end up in the same second round boat, even though you did the right thing, and you get the best version of Embiid? Like, that would be kind of my disaster scenario for them, more than, maybe not more than, but I guess that's top of mind for me compared to the chemistry being off. Because honestly, the quote-unquote worst-case scenario of this is just Maxey cooks this possession, then Paul George cooks this possession, then Embiid cooks for these three possessions, and then we go back to Maxey, and it just feels my turn, your turn. Like, that isn't my favorite type of offense, but part of bringing the top-end talent together is that, in a worst-case scenario, we can't just win without top-end talent. And so if the defense is at a level, which with Embiid on the court, I think it just can be, shoot, they may be able to talent their way for a first-round win, and you get extra reps there, figure out some things that work. You get to game plan against a very specific team and do very specific things and kind of bear down that way. It may not be the cleanest process getting there, but like they still may end up in a good spot. So I would say don't worry too much yet. Don't worry too much yet. Did you have other Sixer thoughts to add?
No.
Okay. We are getting to our last two questions then. This one's going to come from Jeremy, a podcast extraordinaire. The Pelicans implemented a few Brandon Ingram post-ups in the center of the court with either CJ McCollum or DeJounte Murray using a bat screen and forcing Chicago to switch the matchup for easy looks. They also flared CJ to the three-point line once he set said screen. Are there any other guard wing matchups in the NBA that you'd like to see use this?
The Kings.
It's a very quick answer.
DeMar and De'Aaron Fox, you know. Mm-hmm. What about you? The one that comes to mind?
No, the Kings are a good shout. Like, I honestly, when I got the question, I was just wrapping up Cavs Raptors. So I was like, well, hey, if you want to try to get some quick hitters for Scottie Barnes, you can invert some things, get them in the middle of the floor again. Like, they already tried to dabble with some of that in the Cleveland game. So cool. The thing I struggled isn't the right word, but the thing I struggled with for this question was, I guess for me, it was like less, will this team do it, and more, will this team just do more of it? Because then the next name was like, hey, can you just do that for Jimmy Butler a little bit more? But like him having Tyler Hero screen for him, or Terry Rozier screen for him, or even if you want to go back in Heat years, like having Gabe Vincent set across screen for him, like those aren't new concepts for Miami. But if you were trying to find ways to get Jimmy Butler in particular more involved within the offense and kind of complement the spacier things that they're trying to establish, like Terry or Tyler screening for Jimmy would certainly pop on that front. So like Grady or Emmanuel quickly screening for Scotty and getting him those touches in the middle of the floor, especially with how good of a passer he is. And he's very comfortable just posting up in general, going with his own rhythm and getting good shots generally. Those are top of my head. Like, oh, again, like OKC already uses guard screens. It's more pick and roll stuff to get Shea a matchup. Like, do you want to give Shea mid post touches or free throw line touches in that way? Like, you can.
Well, here's the thing. Shea's gonna get to his mid post touches and his post touches. So.
Pretty much. Yeah. But I guess also just to bounce off of the question from Jeremy that I really liked, like, I really did like that setup. Like, they got Brandon Ingram some really deep catches on that.
Well, yeah. Elbow actions, why you use a guard? But mm-hmm. I think the fact that he was able to get in the middle of the floor with limited help helps, as opposed to him having to move off to it, catch it, get pushed out. I could speak. It's a good setup. I think anytime you have, like, I mean, that's even something New York could do or Philly could do. Anytime you have a small guard plus scoring wing, it's good to do.
There you go.
Lakers are never afraid to throw it out there, by the way.
This is true. Lakers would do it. Naturally, if you want to give Luka Doncic a touch in the middle of the floor, you could do that pretty much whenever. And they have some fun guard partners now between Kyrie, Klay Thompson, and they have some interesting partners there for Luka if they want to go to that setup as well. Trying to think, is there another naturally Orlando just as a concept, so it's not just the inverted pick and roll, but like they'll slice Paolo into the post. So again, it's not something that they not some it wouldn't be a new concept for them, but like they can bump up the volume on that if they want. The Portland with Jeremy Grant question mark. Okay, anyway, last question going to come from Max, who says, in the spirit of Jay Huff, who is your favorite, who is that guy, eyes emoji player, who might go from not seeing the floor at all last year to being a rotation guy this year? Love everything you guys do.
This is a Nekias Duncan All-Star question if I've ever heard it.
Tell you what. Like, I have half of mine.
Wait a minute. You don't have one?
No, I was going to say, like, I had half of mine just have Salon from Charlotte, if he could do things inside the arc or defend, but I don't know if we're going to get that. But also, he's just a rookie, so that wouldn't count anyway. Outside of that, like, is it just the high as the keys? Would it just be the Atlanta contingent? Like, if it's just Kobe Bufkin, you are now in the rotation as backup guard. as I did generally enjoy what he did with the ball in his hands during preseason. I don't know if I said that on the preseason pod.
I like that idea. Did you have any others?
Not right now.
Really?
Yeah.
Does Chris Murray count?
I mean, yes. I guess him or Ryan Rupert would count, as they both got minutes last night.
Like, does Javonte Green count?
I don't know if I would count Javonte. I mean, he played last year.
So it eliminates these people who just didn't exist last year?
Well, I mean, hey, if Jay Huff is the reference track.
Cheese and rice. I mean, what, does Kai Jones count then?
He can. He's bouncy, et cetera. Kai would count. Yabusele would count. Because we've seen him before, but he seems like he's going to factor into the Philly rotation. Honestly, the real answer is just Jay Huff, the summer league legend. And Buddy, he gives some good minutes.
Yeah, that's all I got right now.
That's just a big fella that can shoot the basketball. And that is good stuff. Okay, well, that's the end of the list. Did you have any closing basketball thoughts before we get out of here?
Does Ben Simmons count?
No. Absolutely. I'm not letting you do this. Actually, you know what? That's a great time. That's a great place to end. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us. You can follow me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter if you haven't already. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties.
Click on the link and watch basketball with us.
Well, there you go. You heard the man. Say too much more from that. It is free to create your profile. No shenanigans. But Steve said it better than I would. So come watch some hoops with us. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Sorry about that. Great show, Nikas. I'm just hungry. It's time to go one hand on plate, one hand on bone.